Welcome to Are You at Risk, a podcast from Minnesota Lawyers Mutual Insurance Company. Here are your hosts, Todd Scott with Joy Melvin Griffin and Kiernan Waters.
Hi, welcome back to Are You at Risk, the podcast about legal malpractice. I am Todd Scott. I'm the Vice President of Risk Management at Minnesota Lawyers Mutual Insurance Company, and I'm here with two of my very best colleagues, Kiernan Waters.
Hi, everyone.
And Joy Melvin Griffin.
Hello.
There we go. Obviously, this is a podcast about legal malpractice, and as much as we'd like to make this interesting and talk about all the crazy stuff that we see while we work in our jobs for a professional liability carrier, I knew this day would come where we have to talk about data.
And
pie charts, bar graphs, things like that. But there's this thing that happens about every 4 years. I don't know if it's every 3 years or 4 years. And it's not leap year or a presidential election or the U.S. Olympics, but it is in our world, the ABA Standing Committee on Professional Liability publishes data from their most recent study. And it's data based upon sort of a three-year slice of time where they look at malpractice claims statistics from a whole bunch of companies in North America, including our own, and they let everybody know where all the malpractice claims are coming from. So it is get out your popcorn time for us to sort of see, okay, what's the trends that are happening here in our world? And I got to confess, I've been looking at these things since the 90s, and almost always the charts didn't change very much. I'll talk a little bit more about that as we get going, until a few years ago. And then this year, there was actually quite a major change that occurred. And that has to do with which practice area is reporting the most malpractice claims. So just a little bit more about the data, though. It is done by the ABA Standing Committee, and it's a nice way to not only find out which practice areas are reporting the most claims, but what are the claims outcomes. Typically, we call that claim disposition. You know, do they get resolved where nobody loses any money, or do they end up, how often do people end up going to trial defending their good name and reputation with malpractice? There's other things that happens. We get to kind of find out how many of these claims are just kind of never go anywhere as well. We'll start with the sort of the high level stuff, which is just about which practice areas are reporting the most. And so, Kiernan, I'm going to start with you though, because I mean, this is like the errors tour for you. You were there on site.
I could not get my hand on this booklet fast enough. Yes, I did pre-order it. I didn't wait in the three-hour Ticketmaster line, but yes. close as you can get in our profession.
Were you in the front row? Did you tell everybody like how this happens? And for those who might be geeking out on this kind of stuff as much as we are, and why you were interested in being there when this data is released.
I mean, this book, so it is a four-year study, and you're right, like things haven't been changing up until recently. And this particular study covers the years 2020 to 2023, right? A big change occurred across the world, but especially how it impacted our profession. All the data that we were kind of waiting for while we were in the throes of the pandemic is now going to be illuminated through the data in this particular study, since it covers those pandemic years exactly, 2020 through 2023. So we know what happens. We know what the risk was before everything kind of stopped during that time and things changed. And we know now also how we got out of it and where we stand now. And there was a lot of of uncertainty about the courts being closed and a backlog of cases and were claims being filed, were people waiting to file malpractice claims once the courts open back up again, depending on the outcomes of, you know, this, that, and the other. Plus, with the tolling of the statute of limitations during that time and other things, there were a lot of ways, people working from home, right? A lot of ways for things to go wrong and for clients or other people to be unhappy and to file a claim against an attorney as a result of everything, the upheaval that these pandemic years caused. So this book in particular was, I mean, we've been really looking forward to it just to see how things played out since it's going to be such a direct snapshot of that particular data. Now, the other reason that we were excited is because we've been poring over the last book for the last 4 years, and I'm glad to have something new to read now. so as soon as this came out, which it usually comes out, what, September? So we order it, we get our hands on it, and we start poring through it. And then, you know, I think all of us kind of go around in our localities and talk about the data with some of our bar associations and firms and lawyers who are interested in it, because we really want to help our firms and any lawyer keep their risk low. And this is the most up-to-date data of where the risks are occurring. So best way to be preventative is to know what to look for. And this is the data that we look towards to tell us what's going on.
Yeah. Joy, you do a lot of teaching like I do, and we're in front of lawyer groups. Well, we all do that, but why is this information important? And I mean, when you're trying to help lawyers understand about how they may be vulnerable to certain types of claims.
So being that we come from the malpractice carrier, and we are not just in the business of educating, which is probably our most important aspect, but we also provide the insurance, right? So what's happening is if they're getting the information and they're understanding how certain areas of practice are more vulnerable than others, have higher claims than others, maybe have lower claims, then now there is a correlation and a better understanding about how their premium may look, right? So if we see that one area of practice, and this is the analogy that I give right before I do any one of these ethical malpractice or prevention CLEs, when we go through the data, I tell them, you can have the exact same size firm, let's just say a three-person firm, in the exact same locality. One firm can pay $1,000 more than that other firm. And it's not necessarily because of the programs that they use or the software or, you know, how their cyber is set up. Nothing like that. It's simply related to the areas of practice. So these statistics are very, very important in the educational tool that we provide when we ultimately provide the insurance to them.
The well, I don't know about you guys, but when I first see the data, and I'm like you, I wait for this thing to come out because I'm getting sick of looking at data that's, you know, 3-4 years old, and or having to put that up in front of a large group of lawyers and saying this is the most, you know, this is the riskiest practice area. So anyway, so when I get it though, usually the first thing I go to is that pie chart that shows claim frequency. And it's broken down by practice area. And this is kind of getting into, if anything is newsworthy in our world about this thing, this is where the news is made. Well, for a long time, it was, like I said, these pie charts looked almost exactly the same. And the people that got sued the most were the plaintiff's personal injury lawyers. And they had the biggest piece of the pie. And some years, it was like 25% of the pie were claims reported by these lawyers. Okay, so during the start of, I think it was 2008 or 2009, you know, after the downfall in the economy, what do we call that era?
Recessions?
Yeah, the Great Recession. There we go. Yeah, and so, and we'll get to that, how the economy affects claim activity too. But for the first time ever, something other than plaintiff's personal injury took up the biggest piece of the pie. And at that time, it was real estate, because all these real estate deals were had fallen through because of the recession. There was no other buyer sitting there waiting to run in and save the day. And And so, and what do people do when a deal falls through and they lose a lot of money and they can't blame anybody? They look and
sue their attorney.
Sue the attorney. It's like, let's look through all the work and see if this lawyer screwed up. So that was like the first time ever that somebody, but then it went back to plaintiff's personal injury. Well, now we have another one of those moments. And this time it is, ta-da, estate, trust, and probate. In this case, it went from fourth place in 2019 to the number one place in this current study. And I think we all expected this to happen.
I was going to say, not a surprise, not right? Not a surprise.
I don't think the surprise was the number one spot. I think the surprise was the jump from four to one.
Okay, yeah. There you go. And, you know, we can talk about number two was plaintiff's personal injury. I'll get to that. Kiernan, you and I have done programs of advising lawyers on estate planning and probate. So first of all, why don't you give people a little bit of a sense of why this area is such a hot spot right now for lawyers that practice in this area?
Such a hot spot. Yeah. So I am guilty of being a former estate planning attorney, but you know, I left private practice 5 years ago. But even back then, so before this data set came out, you know, well before the pandemic, we knew that it was getting riskier and riskier. And part of it is that elder law has been kind of put into this category. We kind of consider them a little bit separate depending on like the work being done. But that's part of it. And there's really so many reasons. I mean, like if you wanted to start throwing things out there, it probably is a leading contributor to why the estate and trust and probate world has so many complaints. I think without the pandemic, it still would have been in the top five. I think the pandemic maybe pushed it up to that number one spot because of some of the issues that came out of the pandemic and planning for, you know, the people being sick and everything else that was kind of going around, or just the media attention that came to having a will, having a healthcare power of attorney during those years. But even without that, there have been talk of the silver tsunami, which is just the baby boomer generation getting older. It is the largest generation we have. There is a lot of activity that's going on. And it's also one of, I think, the greatest transfer of wealth, like in our nation's history, with the baby boomers passing that generational wealth down in these estate planning documents. The other aspect of this is that these tax laws have been changing. They've been changing, you know, over the last couple of decades, but maybe more changes or more uncertainty in the changes, if these things are going to send down or not send down, you know, different aspects of the tax laws and just the complexity in the tax laws and the amount of wealth that's going on. Attorneys aren't always known for being like great at math. So you definitely want to have an accountant involved for some of those tax details, because planning for some of the tax consequences, especially when you're looking at, you know, million and billion dollar estates, It gets very, very complicated. Irrevocable trust, revocable. I mean, like, there's a lot going on in this kind of small industry here. So the silver tsunami, the changing tax laws, then you add in the pandemic. But I think there's like other things that you can throw in here too. I mentioned elder law, and like guardianships are a big part of that. You know, with Britney Spears and stuff like that in the news, I think there's renewed attention on some of these issues. And there's also more ways for beneficiaries or just people to litigate issues that have resulted out of this. In fact, Maryland has a new-ish claim that a beneficiary can make that is interference in a bequest. Intentional interference with an inheritance, so also known as inheritance interference, is now an actual claim that can be made if someone thinks they should have been included in grandma's trust, but if it wasn't for that cousin talking up grandma's ear at her bedside, they were the interference, and now this person doesn't get the 25% that they thought they were going to get. So there's more ways for families to litigate. And there's also kind of just a renewed, you know, with pro bono and low bono fees and stuff, there's just more access to making these things into bigger issues than they are, especially when it's an emotional time because of a potential loss or a health issue or whatever the situation may be. That's kind of the catalyst for these things to go off.
Wow. Who would ever want to practice in estate planning and probate? Well, and Joy, I mean, because it's a hot area, I suppose that attracts new lawyers or people that this might not be their main gig, but they want a side hustle and maybe, oh yeah, I can do some of these things, especially if somebody with a large estate kind of lands in their lap, things like that too. So any advice for people that are practicing in this area?
I'm so glad you said that. So ding, ding, ding. I think that is where we want to start. Not just necessarily the newer attorneys. And of course, when we come into a new firm and we're taking on any area of practice, 5.1 dictates a lot about supervising attorneys and making sure that we are giving them the tools that they need in order to be able to carry out whatever area of practice they may wind up in. However, I dare to take this a little further and say that if I were to conduct some sort of study on why this increase, yes, we've got silver tsunami, as Kiernan alluded to, but I think we miss the concept sometimes of COVID and the effects that it had on litigators. So, for example, if we were seeing that during COVID, there was a criminal trial where we were thinking that a preliminary hearing was going to be set in, I don't know, let's say July. But because the courts kept sending out notices and notices saying, no, this is being pushed back, this is being pushed back, now they've got to find money somewhere. Because, you know, as attorneys, we can't just take the money out of trust until we've earned it. So I think they were dabbling, as we like to call it, into these areas because, like you said, it was easier, especially when you have something that, you know, that glitters and it looks like it could be a high estate. And so now we're saying, oh, OK, let's hurry up and help them out.
Also, such a need for it, too.
Yes.
I mean, people, right, you know, it's like, okay, hey, my DUI practice has dried up right now, but all these people are banging down my door because they're nurses and teachers or they have family in a nursing home and they need these documents because of everything that the pandemic has going
yes.
on. So, I mean, it just created a perfect situation, a perfect storm mm-hmm. for things to get derailed and for people to go into it without having, you know, you're not working in an office, so there's not that water cooler talk to even have a mentor maybe review your documents. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of documents. That's the other issue. There's lots of documents out there. There's lots of places online where you can get a will form, and I do not recommend it. No attorney would. But that also created some layers of issues, just having people have try to attempt their own documents from something they got offline, an attorney now trying to fix that for them if they don't have a background in that versus that attorney starting from scratch. But of course, you know, money is a concept in this too, right? People don't want to spend more than they're willing to, especially if they can find a cheap way to do it online these days.
A little consolation out of all of this is in my claims time, one of the things that I would see is not necessarily that the attorney was being sued directly for some sort of error or omission related to, you know, a will, a power of attorney, whatever it was. It was more so that from generally the baby boomer generation, where someone was upset, kind of like what you were saying before, Kiernan, right? Someone got upset yep. because they thought Aunt such and such should have left me with this. And so when it didn't happen, now they filed this will contest clause, but the attorney has to be subpoenaed in order to be able to talk about the testator's intent. Well, now when you have an attorney that's subpoenaed, if they have insurance, which we all know we should have, they're calling the insurance company for subpoena assistance testimony, right? And so that in and of itself is a claim. We handle that the same way we would anything else. And that's all insurance companies generally speaking, I should say. But I just wanted to touch on a point that Kiernan made before, and this is just a little bit of advice to our attorneys out there. Kiernan spoke about people like me, the attorneys who are not good in math, the ones who went to law school to avoid math.
Wait, right? There are attorneys good at math? I did not know.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
Who are these people?
Where? I don't know. So with that being said, you know, one of the things that I would always suggest attorneys to do when you're in these different areas of practice. And it doesn't just come up in wills, trusts, and estates. It comes up very frequently in family law. If you, there will be sometimes tax issues. And if you are not a tax professional, which a lot of us are not, there should be something in the engagement agreements or retainer agreements mm-hmm. that say, I am not a tax professional. Yeah. In order to receive advice in this area, you need to seek the services of a third party.
And that's not the broker. That's not the, you know, the financial advisor who's maybe bringing clients into your office. We're talking about a CPA or a legitimate tax advisor for this type of stuff, because estate taxes are different from, you know, the regular taxes that we file. So you need that expertise in it. Absolutely.
Kiernan, while we wrap up this estate thing, where do you think this is going? Is it going to get worse?
It's going to get worse. I don't know the end date for when the baby boomers will be completely shuffling off this mortal coil, as Shakespeare might say. But that's going to be, you know, that'll be the final hurdle to get over, because there'll still be a lot of issues in wrapping up those estates. And with so many estates, it's going to be interesting to see kind of how that plays out. One of the other things that's going to exacerbate this issue is dementia and Alzheimer's and other things like that, that are going to be affecting the baby boomer generation more and more as they continue to age. I mean, people are certainly living longer, which also means they need more money into their retirement or into their senior years. Mm-hmm. But the mental capacity is a big issue that attorneys can run into, because, you know, a client could have mental capacity the first time you meet with them and then not after that. It really gets dependent on the situation, and family has a lot of opinions about whether grandma was in the right state of mind or not. And there's so many things that just influence that at different times of day and different times of year and different types of illnesses. So keeping in mind, you know, the mental capacity at any given time for your client, and making sure they're understanding, especially if you're involved in some tax planning or, you know, Medicaid planning for an irrevocable trust. Like, those things are so complicated. It's really hard to wrap your mind around. There's the potentiality for, you know, giving up, like divesting yourself of the property you own to save it in those forms. So it just gets really complicated, and you really have to have, you know, an awareness of the planning and how it's going to work out for yourself and your family members or your beneficiaries into the future and that kind of stuff. And another point kind of tailing off on that is knowing who your client is, right? Because mom and dad or your kids, you know, it might be a different person that's paying the bill for these estate planning documents to get done or this tax planning work to get done. And so you have to make sure that it's not always maybe the person paying the bill or the person that's driving your client to the office. You have to be working for the best interests of your client here. And that's mm-hmm. also can potentially cause issues if a family member disagrees or isn't in the room, because maybe they shouldn't be in the room. They probably shouldn't be in the room because you want that one-on-one with the person who is your client. So keep things simple. Only talk to your client whenever possible. Not always possible because of these nosy family members and stuff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's a way to avoid a lot of distrust and a lot of potential issue down the line too. Making sure you know who your client is and are doing everything with their best interest in mind and only communicating with them unless they have given you clear instructions to communicate with their power of attorney or somebody else, right? Yeah.
Well, let's talk about some of the other things that became apparent during this study. I was mistaken. I spoke earlier. I said that plaintiff's personal injury is in second place. No, it's in third place. And just to give people a little bit of perspective, I'm actually looking at the numbers now. When I say something was in first place, estate, trust, and probate, that was, it's about 13.5% of all claims reported by these companies. Real estate was in second place, and that includes both commercial and residential. Just a little bit under that, about 13.2%. And then came plaintiff's personal injury, which is 12.7%. I got to stop right there. Like I said, this is jaw-dropper to somebody like me who's been doing this for a long time. And also, I began my career working for a plaintiff's personal injury firm. And boy, we always felt like, you know, hey, we're in the most riskiest practice area. And not only in terms of frequency, but how costly it is to resolve mm-hmm. these things. But and so at one point, it was taking up 25% of the pie. And now I'm just saying it's 12%. I think this is still one of those things that's kind of an enigma. I think, you know, I guess I'm a practice management advisor, so I'm going to take all the credit for these people having fewer claims. But, you know, that maybe they're finally listening. But for a long time, we thought, you know, because so much of that was calendaring problems, things slipping through the cracks, and you know how it is. If something doesn't get sued out on time, then all you can do at that point is just figure out what were the damages, you know, what was the value of the underlying matter that can no longer be brought to court. And so we encourage systems to these lawyers for so long. Do you guys have any thoughts about what's going on in plaintiff's personal injury? Of course, we still worry about those things, and being in third place is nothing to brag about, but that's clearly, I mean, there are, it's not as risky as it used to be in terms of, at least in terms of frequency. Joy, do you have any thoughts?
Todd, I was just like you. That was my biggest area of practice when I was in general practice. It was personal injury. I was the personal injury attorney at the firm. And I loved it because if we can just have a total transparent moment, you do your work. Yes, you're stressed out when you're trying to, you know, get those medical bills and records in, when you're trying to do this, you're trying to do that. But then the check comes and you're like, okay, now I can make it to the next payday. You know, it's like that, you know, it's that rush that you get after settling a case. But here's the thing. One of the things my mentor always taught me, which I recommend everyone who is an attorney to get a mentor. You are never too old to have a mentor, someone that you can bounce ideas off of. And so when I'm bouncing ideas off of him, he says, listen, when you get to your year mark in Virginia, we have a 2-year statute of limitations. When you get to your year after the date of the incident, there needs to be a calendar reminder. Mm-hmm. 6 months, there needs to be a calendar reminder. When you get to that 4-month mark, I don't care if you think settlement is around the corner. File suit to protect your statutes. And I think that constitutes the once 25%, now 12.7%. It's that we become too trusting of the auto insurance companies at time. Mm-hmm. And we really just need to make sure that it's not saying that the adjuster has done something wrong. Have that talk with the adjuster and let them know, hey, I'm coming too close to my statute. I am going to file. Yes, we know that it's irritating because they usually send us to another adjuster as soon as attorney gets on the case, but it's protecting your client and it's protecting your license.
Yeah. Well, and that's all great advice. Well, gosh, there's just so many things you could talk about in this data and what comes with it, but I'm kind of just trying to cover the things that really popped out and potentially could be a new trend. So,
We've got another one, don't we?
Yeah. Well, the one that actually rose the most and doubled in this period of time from 3% to 6%. That doesn't sound like a lot, but that is a lot. Patent, trademark, and copyright did increase the most in this latest report. And these are, now it's, I always tell people when we talk about this data too, I'm just showing, usually I like to show the pie chart, you know, and I tell the audience, I go, look, you're looking at a frequency chart, which is, you know, who's getting sued the most. But if I were to show a severity chart showing how expensive it is to resolve these claims, some of these things that are the thinnest slices of the pie would be become very, very fat. You know, people, lawyers that work in securities or people that work in anything financial where there's a lot of money at stake, things like that. But patent, trademark, and copyright, that was you traditionally one of the thinnest pieces of the pie. And I think it's getting jealous of commercial real estate and estate and trust and probates because it's trying to get fatter overnight here too. So, Kiernan, you know, what type of claims do we see or do we worry about with the people that do that? I know that a lot of it, because that's deadline intensive as well, and these people have to have
and
calendars.
And so technical sometimes, right?
Like
very technical with these patents and trademarks. And, you know, I think the big fight is with China right now and what China's doing with their laws and how they're handling patents and trademarks that might have been filed and registered in the U.S. I also think with AI, we're going to be seeing I think this patent, trademark, and copyright is going to remain kind of in an area to watch with technology and startups and all this kind of stuff that's going on. We'll see where it goes.
Mm-hmm. Of course, everybody's idea is a $1 million idea. And so if something goes wrong with registering the foreign patents on time or something like that, you know, it's big bucks. And defending these things are big bucks too. I think the first time I ever saw a $1,000 an hour lawyer was somebody who was a defense expert in this area. And so, and that $1,000 is probably peanuts compared to what would be now, but you get the idea too. So, you know, okay, so let's kind of do the grab bag portion of this discussion here too. We all kind of have our little things that we look for, and I'll start. There's a couple of things that always intrigue me, and one of them, though, has to do with claims by size of firms. And there's this weird statistic that happens in there. Please don't go look it up. But it's like one of these things. I've been staring at these charts for too long, but there's this thing where first of all, it shows that if you're a solo practitioner, you're likely to get you're the most likely to get claims. But then what I like to do is when I'm talking about these things publicly, I'll have like two charts next to each other. And so I'll show this claims by size of firms. And then right next to it, I'll show, you know, basic lawyer demographics. And so if lawyers in private practice make up three quarters of them are solo attorneys, but they're reporting half of the claims, that's a good risk. And so, and then there's, let's go to the larger firms. You start to get into these firms that are 25, 50, 100 lawyers per firm, and they start to report the fewest amount of claims too, and things like that. 6 to 10, they report about 9 or 10% of the claims, but they make up about 10 or 11% of lawyers in private practice. So they're roughly an even risk. So that's good. But there's this piece of the pie that's right in the middle, and it's lawyers who work in firms of 2 to 5. And they make up 15% of lawyers in private practice, but they report a third of the freaking claims. They're very disproportionate to how they make up lawyer demographics, this firm size of 2 to 5. So anyway, like I said, we're going to geek out on numbers. So this is my shot. But, you know, so what is it? I think it has a lot to do with law office systems. If you're a solo attorney, you know how it is. It's all in your shoulders. You're the one that's sitting up on Sunday nights.
You're juggling all the plate.
Going over invoicing and billing and all that kind of stuff. And you tend to stay in your lane too. And then if you're in the larger firms, there's very much part of the firm culture. Hey, stay in your lane. You're an estate planning lawyer. Why are you doing this DWI or this car accident case for your brother-in-law or whatever, you know? But it's that group of 2 to 5s that they tend to work like a group of solos without rules or something, where they kind of they're kind of more like cowboys out in the prairie. They kind of will be the type of firms where somebody turns out next door is handling some railroad car accident case, and the other partners in the firm might not even know that anything about the status of that case, or it might not be the specialty of that lawyer. So anyway, that's sort of where of these things where I kind of geek out on that is firm size. This thing proves that there are certain things about firm size that do affect how likely you are to report malpractice. All right. So tossing it back at you, is there anything else that stands out when you look at this stuff and gives you things to point out to clients?
You know, Ty, I would piggyback number one on what you're saying and kind of just tie that into what I was saying earlier. The firm size, also it's something that across the board, malpractice insurance companies have to look at when they're setting rates, right? Mm-hmm. Because of those statistics. Like you said, when we first started, this is a legal profile of, I think they even went as far as up as Canada. So it's, and it's nationwide. It's a mm-hmm. lot of different resources coming together just to, you know, paint that picture. So when you are, you know, solo, when you are a small firm, you might say, gosh, why is my rate here as a solo so much higher than when it was when I was at a firm that, you know, maybe had 25? Well, that might be the reason, because the percentage or the likelihood of committing a claim is higher. But the only other thing that I will say is, we see a lot of, I see a lot of attorneys, especially in when I'm giving the CLEs, and they say, how is criminal? You know, how does criminal work in all of this, especially in defense groups? And criminal is pretty low. I mean, it's 3.7%. However, the thing about criminal is, I just want us to kind of make sure we're taking all of this in context. Ineffective assistance of counsel is probably the highest claim that we see in criminal. And yes, you know, you can see this. Someone goes to jail or to prison, I should say. They become friends with, you know, the lawyer, the jailhouse lawyer, right? And so now they know enough to be dangerous. They're going to file this petition many, many, many times. And this goes into the number of claims that are resolved. And I don't want to spoil the surprise that I'm sure we have coming in just a little bit. But when you look at the number of claims that are dismissed early on, a lot of them are those criminal petitions of ineffective assistance of counsel, because the petition might have been filed in error, right? So usually procedurally they're thrown out, but substantively, a lot of it doesn't work because it's just their last ditch effort. And it can't be proven that the lawyer did not give their all. So I would just reiterate that for any client that we obtain, whether it's through the public, court appointed, whatever it is, we do have to continue to give our all, even if we know without a shadow of a doubt that the real thing that we're going to argue there is not guilt or innocence, but it's only going to be sentencing. Whatever it is, we just need to give it our all and do our due diligence.
Yeah, yeah. Those, like I said, sometimes those little thin slices of the pie can be very problematic. Criminal, another thing is not explaining the immigration consequences of somebody taking a guilty plea. That's become a big, big deal. And of course, that lawyer is going to get sued if the family gets broken up and somebody gets sent back to their country of origin because they pleaded guilty to something that they potentially could have been defensible. And also, Kiernan, any other things you, when you're paging through, that you look at and you go, wow, okay, there's a lesson here?
Well, I really just thought that this kind of tied a bow on those pandemic years and how it affected the practice of law across the U.S. I think we may have been waiting for more of an avalanche in this. Like, I think we thought that it was going to be worse data. And I think we were relieved that it is what it is. And it's certainly manageable and that we're also coming out of it pretty quickly. I think we thought that the kind of the shadows of the pandemic would last and have a longer impact, especially on, you know, the areas of practices that were really affected by it. But I think this data shows that we have moved on. The practice of law is moving forward. You know, we didn't see a huge spike. I mean, the real estate, as you mentioned earlier, is the number two. You know, I think we were expecting a little bit more issues within that area of practice because of the economic uncertainty that the pandemic in the recent years has provided. Because we know, looking back, and you alluded to this at the beginning of this conversation, Todd, but looking back at 2008, we saw a big rise, a steep increase in claims following that recession. And so during the pandemic, I know there was a lot of economic uncertainty that really continued and is still continuing, maybe because of the election and everything else that's going on in our country. But I think this is not as dire as maybe we were expecting. And I mean, especially, you know, we're in the insurance world, so we're risk averse and, you know, clutching our pearls over here. That's what's going to happen. But I do think it's a really interesting snapshot of the pandemic years. And I think the years here for this quadrennial study just worked out well turmoil to have it in this one study, the kind of the before and the after. And hopefully we can move on and just return to how things were. But knowing where the risk is in these things, and essentially, I think it's a back to basics approach, right? You know, even with all the great technology and AI and everything that we have going on, it's calendaring, it's knowing who your client is, it's being in communication. You don't need all the bells and whistles. You just have to do those basic aspects of this profession correctly. And that's your best bet for avoiding a claim.
Yeah. Hey, so Joy, since you alluded to it, maybe this is a great way to wrap up, which is, what is the data on the disposition of claims, we call it. When they report on this data, they break it up into five categories. The one that gets the most claims land in the area, that's where it's called no payment claim abandoned, meaning, you know, that could be a number of things. Somebody called the company, reported a claim out of an abundance of caution. Some client got mad at them, and the lawyer thought that they might have had a problem. So a claim was started officially in our books, but it doesn't necessarily mean in the end, by the time the claim is closed, nothing came of it. And that number is actually pretty high. It's over 80% of the claims, 82%.
Which is great. Everybody breathe a sigh of relief, right?
Yes. Yeah,
there you go.
Definitely.
And the other categories, and it progressively gets worse. Claims settled with payment and a suit was filed. Claim was settled with payment, but no suit was filed. Or maybe a suit was filed, but it was eventually dismissed. Judgment for the defendant. That's a great place to be. And then the most horrible place to be, I guess, on this other side of the spectrum is payment judgment for plaintiff, meaning that, you know, that poor claimant ended up going thoroughly into litigation, but very few result in that. Matter of fact, the percentage is 0.03%, ended up that way. So 4 out of 10,000. So it gives you a sense of how insurers like to deal with these things. I don't think people like to take matters that far on principle and things like that. In the areas where they're settled here, I'll just start giving you some numbers. So settled, no payment after a suit was filed, about just over 9%. And then the ones where maybe it was settled okay, let me make my screen a little bit bigger. Sorry, guys.
I got you. Where there was no suit filed, and it was about 5.7%.
There you go. Yep. And then where a suit was filed and it was settled is the 9%. And then suit dismissed, judgment for plaintiff at about 3%. So the vast majority, going back to what you were saying earlier, Joy, the vast majority, nothing ever comes of it. But so I guess that's why we have that statistic that we like to repeat, which is, hey, you became a lawyer, you're going to have a claim. It's just, you're going to have a couple of these in your career.
It's par for the course.
Welcome to the profession.
Yep. Yep.
So
it's not the end of the world, not the end of your career.
Right. But let's just make sure everyone understands, this was data compiled from several different insurance companies.
Yeah.
When you don't have insurance, we don't have those statistics, and I can guarantee you that those numbers are going to change drastically, right? Mm-hmm. So having insurance likely helps a lot of that 82%, because now you have someone advocating on your behalf, as we do it, you know, in our profession every day. So
I'm taking the emotion out of it, right? I mean, I know in Maryland, for whatever reason, it seems that these letters from our Attorney Grievance Commission get sent out on a Friday. Like, they arrive in our mailboxes on Friday afternoons. Like, oh, like, what a way to start the weekend. You know what I mean? These poor attorneys who are working, you know, so many hours in their day, and then this is what they have hanging over them as they enter their weekend. And there's just, you know, no rest, no relief. But you're exactly right. Like, the bad news is that it's going to come. These letters are going to be there. Something's going to happen. It doesn't mean you did anything wrong. It doesn't mean that anything's going to happen to you. And it's probably just going to go away, because that's how these things work out.
Yeah. When I did handle claims many years ago, it was, I kind of sometimes felt like a counselor, you know, and it's like, well, first of all, we're not going to yell at you. And this is why you have insurance. So obviously there's so much more we could talk about. We'll probably be addressing, you know, chunks of this stuff as we get into some other topics and upcoming podcasts. So anyway, but at least we wanted to give everybody a flavor as to, you know, what's newsworthy in our world. And boy, estate, trust, and probate, you know, keep your eye on that one. So, hey, we're at the end of our time. So thank you, Joy. Thank you, Kiernan.
Thanks, Todd. Thanks, Todd.
Great to work with you guys again. And thanks to everybody for checking out our podcast. See you later.
Are You at Risk is hosted by Todd Scott, Joy Melbourne Griffin, and Kiernan Waters. Production support by Carol Greethurst. Music by Audio Beats. Recorded and edited by Beth K. Gibbs of Lyft Podcasting. For more information, visit mlmins.com. That's mlmins.com.